Hey everybody, welcome to another Baseball America Prospects podcast. I'm Kyle Glazer. We're joined today on the phone by Mike Berardino, formerly of the St. Paul Pioneer Press, longtime Baseball America Twins correspondent and former BA employee. Mike recently left to become the Notre Dame football beat writer for the Indianapolis Star, but he was kind enough to still put together the Twins top 10 for us. Mike, real quick, how are you enjoying the college football life compared to the baseball life?
Well, it certainly is a change of pace, but it doesn't hurt to step into a season that they're unbeaten to this point, and trying to win their first national championship in 30 years. So I'm sitting in the O'Hare Airport right now because of travel problems, but going to cover them against Syracuse at Yankee Stadium. So I'll be back in a baseball environment, but covering football, which is kind of appropriate.
Absolutely. No, definitely definitely kind of a fun mix there. Obviously, you were part of the Twins coverage team for a very long time. You've known this system as intimately as anyone. I want to start with the discussion this year. Royce Lewis is once again the Twins' number one prospect. How close of a debate was it between him and Alex Kirilloff in your discussions with front office officials and scouts? Was it pretty clear that Royce was still the number one, or was there a little bit of debate there?
I think the separation remains for two reasons. What, Royce is a one draft class later, a year older, a year younger, and he's staying at shortstop for the foreseeable future if and when he were to move to another spot, and played other spots in high school. That dip in positional value might, if Kirilloff keeps hitting like that, might make it almost a flat-footed tie, as they say. Right now, they're pretty close. I mean, I did try to make sure that we had it in the right order, but those are the main reasons that Royce is still at the top of that heap, and both of them are trending so well.
Yeah, Royce in particular had a really nice year at low A. High A, hit a little bit of scuffles, but nothing unusual for the Florida State League. What kind of player can Twins fans, look forward to? Are we talking about, an all-star shortstop? Are we talking about, a perennial all-star shortstop? Just, again, now that he has a full season under his belt and evaluators at the pro level have really sunk his teeth into him, what level of talent are they seeing?
Well, we certainly don't want to overload him with too much, and I don't want to get too far out there, but I mean, you don't get to be a top 10, he's top 10 overall in your top 100, and you don't get to be at the top of that list in your draft year unless you have all the potential things you laid out. I don't think at this stage, yet to play above high A, and as you said, he's also had a sustained scuffle there in the Midwest League as well. Two separate slumps that he had to fight his way out of, and he did. Also dealing with some patellar tendonitis that is concerning. His shoulder wasn't a problem for him this year, but yes, if he stays healthy and he continues to play full seasons in the minors and have a chance to live up to that ability that's so obvious to scouts and to teammates and the people who've coached and managed him, sure. I mean, Twins fans can dream on a franchise type player. I mean, there's a Jeter level charisma, and I don't know what the worst case is, but the floor is pretty high.
He's definitely an interesting prospect. Obviously teenagers at the Class A levels are never ever a guarantee, not that any prospect is ever a guarantee, but there's definitely a sense that he's done what he needs to do so far. And as you mentioned, he was, a fairly clear-cut number one in a pretty good system. Kirilloff obviously was excellent this year, but I actually wanted to talk about the top pitching prospect in the system in Brewster Graterol. You were ahead of the curve on this. You had submitted Graterol last year as the number five prospect in the system at a time when many people in our office had never even heard of him. And there were other guys who were bigger names, the Nick Gordons of the world, the Steven Gonzalez's of the world. But you had Graterol run up pretty well, and he lived up to that this year. What were some of the things that Gratterall showed last year that gave you that level of confidence in him? And then what was, the overall feedback you got on him this year now that he had a little bit of spotlight on him?
Well, a year ago, trying to remember, I mean, I went back and watched some video. There was, I don't know if it's yours, but I think it was you on YouTube, and from the Gulf Coast League, and I didn't get to see him at all in the Appy League, but just the frame was impressive. The delivery was repeatable. Of course, you're hearing those high velo numbers even in those levels, rookie ball and so forth. And then I got to see him live this year. Of course, last year, I mean, I was told by, I think I put it in the report that there was a high-ranking Twins person who said that he might have had the Gratterall might have had the highest ceiling of anybody in the system at that time, or putting the report together, a year ago. But so that's how you get pushed up into the top five. And I've been doing these since my Marlins days. It's about 20 years off and on of doing these reports for you guys. And you're not going to you're not going to separate yourself at all if you're if you don't listen to the people who guide you properly over the years. And when somebody when somebody pounds the table, as it were, over the phone in this setting, and it happens a few times, then and you're talking about a guy who's touching triple digits, and already got his Tommy John surgery out of the way and added 60 pounds of muscle. I checked on that. That's what they say from the time he signed at 16. Why not? Why not push him up there? So we have another guy in this year's top 10, or somebody said on the chat the other day, it could be, was kind of this year's Gratterall based on where I put him. We'll get to him in a minute, but I feel pretty good about that one too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, who is that player that you feel is potentially next year's Gratterall?
I have no idea. But let me look at my list here. Yoan Duran, the guy who really showed big upside in the Midwest League this year. So, in terms of when we obviously came in trade from the Diamondbacks, and it didn't take him long, well, with his pitch mix and his big velocity, but he's got something that was described to me as a splinker. He kind of spreads his fingers and gets a late movement on this. It's not really a split. It's not a split change. It's just something that's it's a hard, I guess, two seamer, and down and fade. But nice frame, again, repeatable delivery, 55% ground balls, 15% swinging strike rate, and he had been kind of spinning his wheels, it looked like, with the D-backs, but once the Twins got him, he really took off. So I pushed him up there in a system that's it's not awash in pitching talent, a lot more position talent probably overall. I think we pushed him all the way to seven.
Yeah, Duran was the key prospect that came over in the Eduardo Escobar trade. We saw the Twins obviously sell off some veterans at the deadline and bring in a bunch of good prospects. And you mentioned that the system is mostly, position player based. Of your top 10, Gratterall, it's seven position players and three pitchers. And I think the pitchers are, with the exception of Gratterall, they're in the back half. Some of those position players, you mentioned Royce Lewis, staying at short and showing he can do that for now. Wander Javier was one of the top international prospects a few years ago, signed for $4 million. Big things were expected of him coming into the year, but he had injury issues right away in 2016. Did pretty well for himself when he was actually on the field in 2017. But then he needed shoulder surgery that cost him all of 2018. So he's been hampered by injuries now 2 of the last 3 years. He's still top five in this system. What's the overall feel you have on Javier and where he is? Because he will be 21 next year without having played past rookie ball. It's kind of an interesting dynamic with him.
It is. You're really buying in on the tools there, and you're just assuming that he'll be able to stay on the field. I do think, and I've thought for a long time, that the sixth tool in some way was the ability to stay on the field. And he's going to have to prove that. They've been careful with him. Obviously, I think that hamstring he probably could have played through if he'd been more advanced. But the labrum requiring surgery was something that carried over time and had to be fixed. He was fine by their mini camp, though. So that's one reason why you can still believe in the tools and feel like this is a guy who's not going to be sidetracked by his body too much longer. But it does knock him down a peg. I actually was willing to put him as low as 6, I believe. But you guys wanted him back up there at 4. J.J. Cooper he broke that tie, and that's fine. That's fine by me. I'm comfortable with that. But a couple other guys that we'll talk about, I'm sure, bats that had a chance to produce more in the minor leagues. Javier certainly had a nice run there in the Appy League a year ago, but that's almost ancient history.
Moving down, there's a group of recent college draft picks here. You have Trevor Larnach, their first-round pick this year, Brent Rooker, their first-round supplemental pick last year. You even move into Ryan Jeffers, their second-round pick this year. Overall, the Twins, these last couple drafts, have added some of that older, more advanced talent. Rooker already got to Double-A. Larnach finished the year in full-season ball. Jeffers moved very quickly as well. Was there a sense from you that they were, because before it was a lot of high school talent or international talent, was there a sense of picking these guys to, move a little quicker, or was it just a case of these are the best guys available, let's take them?
Well, they already liked Rooker, having tried to sign him, almost signing him, I guess, out of the 38th round, but then he went back to school and it worked out very nicely for him. But they also, with the trademark pending Falvin administration, these decisions, as they are around the game, are made more and more in conjunction between the scouting department and the analytics department. And in each case, there were analytics reasons to get excited about that player and what would could still be tweaked. Small changes that could still be made on into pro ball to build off of what they've done in college ball. So Rooker was the first case, and had a tremendous half season, the first pro ball season, and a ton of power. This year in 18, he experienced some ups and downs, and I mentioned in the report that you don't hear as much conviction about turning him into a left fielder anymore, so that does hurt his potential positional value a little if you're talking about purely a first baseman who's, in the conversation I had, doesn't sound like he's going to be much more than an average first baseman at best, or a DH. But the bat is real, and the bat is advanced, and certainly, he's a thinker, so he's going to get the most out of what the analytics department brings to him. Larnach obviously should have been just exhausted coming off of the College World Series star turn, but he really managed to hit the ground running, and they loved his curiosity and the way he's already remade his swing with the help of analytics, and they think that he can get to more of his pull side power in addition to what he already has, which is easy power to the opposite gap. And not a ton of positional value there either. And again, where you see guys who are polished college hitters with limited positional value in those two cases, it probably was an analytics shared conviction. And so that kind of tilted the playing field toward that pick. It's a little lower pick than the Twins have been making in the first round at 20, but he's made them look good so far, so we put him where we did. And then Jeffers was interesting because, I guess the competition level was lower at UNC Wilmington, and one of the things I kept hearing was they loved his pitch framing, but Sean Johnson said it on draft day that it was that they really thought he could frame at a level that would allow him to stay at catcher, even though there are questions in the scouting community about some of his footwork and his mobility back there, but he can frame and to a large extent. And in the modern game, that's what the teams want to see from their catchers. They're willing to give a little to get more framing. They just are really valuing that, and the Twins are at the forefront of that. So that helps convince a prospect writer, in this case, that he can stay at catcher. We'll see. There's doubts out there about that. But if the Twins are going to value the framing above all else in terms of the defense for catcher, well, Ryan Jeffers' bat, which was tremendous, will stay there. Another really sharp kid, physics major at UNC Wilmington, so he's already had a chance to pick Josh Koch's brain, or at least do a lot of listening, which is wise. Talk to him about that. And so, yeah, you're a good point that there's a bit of a trend going on there toward the college hitter, where the Twins for a long time were looking for that potential five-tool high school athlete and willing to roll the dice in that direction.
Yeah, you know, I just went back and quick checked it. The Twins went college with six of their top seven picks this year. The only other time they've done that this decade was 2014. So, you know, this entire decade, this was as college heavy as a draft as they've ever had. Looking at this top 10 as a whole, there is a mix, international, high school, college. How many of these guys were firmly in the top 10, and how many were kind of, you know, open, they could be, but there was a challenger?
I think I had about 12 to 14 really good candidates for the top 10, and it just kind of fell this way. I wouldn't say that Junior Severino at 10 was a force or a compromise pick necessarily. I might have him a slot or two higher, but the conviction on the bat was high enough that I was able to overlook some of the concerns from outside the organization about the athleticism or the positional value, which is already limited at second. They still think they can get him to play on the left side of the diamond a little bit, the Twins do. He likes playing at second. He's a Robbie Cano fan, and he sees what you know, how far Cano's been able to go largely with the bat playing second. But there are others. There are other pieces there that people will need to buy the book for, right? We're not supposed to get it. We're not supposed to let people know who 11 through 15 might be. So we encourage them to buy the Prospect Handbook, of course. That's obvious. If they're listening to this podcast, they've already pre-ordered it. But there were definitely a handful of candidates that could have been in that top 10, and no one would have blinked.
Big picture now, you know, the Twins obviously had the worst record in baseball in 2016, rallied back to make the playoffs in 2017. 2018, you know, there was hope and expectation that maybe they would be able to build on that. Instead, things cratered quite a bit. You know, looking at this prospect group in conjunction with who is there at the major league level, what's your sense on, you know, how quickly these guys can really impact the Twins, A, and B, how realistic is it for the Twins to get back to contention? Is it 2019? Is it 2020? Where's their timeline based on their current overall talent, both, you know, major league level and farm system from your vantage point?
They're in a weird spot, Kyle, because, as you mentioned, you know, they did load up payroll-wise. That was a record payroll that they put out there, $128 million for them as a record in this past year with late free agent signings, and it blew up in their face. So they're hoping to have more definitive answers in 2018 on the young core, especially the young positional core. They got a nice answer on Jose Barrios. But and Kyle Gibson gave him a nice surprise, but he's a year away from free agency. But then the young core positionally, you know, starting with Buxton and Sano, still open questions. So, you know, will that lead to a change of scenery trade prospect, or not prospect, but young player for young player maybe this offseason potentially? Will it lead to them running them back out there, the Keplers and Rosarios? Rosario certainly had a tremendous first half and had played through a shoulder problem and some other, and just got pitched to better. They still need to get rid of Polanco. Missed the first half with the suspension. Did some good things in the second. They still need more answers, Kyle, about that core before they can let them get out the door or lock them up for five, years, it seems harder to do that now, to lock people up. Thad Levine did it so well, part of the group down in Texas that did it so well, and he knows and wants to do it, but at the appropriate time. So they're showing restraint. I mean, they did put multi-year offers out there for a handful of guys in the spring, and nobody bid because the union has shown them the, I guess, or convinced in many cases, the idea that patience will pay. So although the way free agency goes anymore, I don't know. So the arbitration system pays still. That's pretty locked in, but once you get to free agency, you know. So I don't really know. I'm sure they'll have a surprise or two up their sleeves. I'm sure they'll delve into free agency a little bit, I guess. But as far as their year, you know, they're on the other side of the Joe Mauer contract, so a lot of people want to see them take that $23 million spot and spread it over two pitchers or something, and maybe they will, but they also just might take it down significantly. I'm just guessing here. No one knows what their payroll range is. It's still a case-by-case basis. But if they don't like the way the market unfolds, if things don't present, as Derek Falvey likes to say, that are tempting, there's no reason they can't take it down closer to where the A's and the Rays were in payroll doing very good things this year than trying to push up into that middle range where you're landlocked. You're not spending enough to keep up with the superpowers, but you also are potentially going to throw away an extra $40 to $50 million that you could spread out through your infrastructure, through multi-year deals, load up for opportunities that will come when you're ready. And Cleveland's window will have a lot to say about how the Twins and the rest of the division act in this offseason, but everybody knows the White Sox are coming, and they're not there yet. But by 2020, 2021, you know, it could be a division that's dominated by the White Sox. So there is a bit of a window.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. You mentioned the struggles of some of those young players. It's always a reminder that there is no such thing as a surefire prospect. Obviously, you know, Byron Buxton and Miguel Sano both hitting sub-200, both getting demoted to the minors. These are guys now, you know, in years 3, 4 of their big league careers, and it's just not clicking the way people expected it to. I mean, from the outside looking in, to be perfectly honest, again, you can tell me if I'm wrong here. Obviously, you have a lot more experience there. But from the outside looking in, you see Eddie Rosario, you know, he's a keeper. You know, Jorge Polanco played well enough. You can throw him in that bucket, too. You mentioned Jose Berrios. You know, Fernando Romero came up and showed some good things, some things to work on, but something to work with definitely. You know, Kyle Gibson's on, you know, he's going to be 31 next season. I mean, I think you could argue there's maybe one or two rotation spots you feel good about. And again, right now, I don't know if there are more than one or two position player spots you feel really good about where the future's coming. So on the one hand, that is going to result in a lot of opportunities for a lot of these prospects in the coming years, but there's still an interim gap. Lewis is still an A-ball. Kirilloff is still an A-ball. These are not guys who are going to be ready to go on opening day next year. Given that, I mean, I guess I feel like almost how much Buxton and Sano are able to bounce back, if at all, will probably have more of a say about the Twins' ability to truly be competitive here in the next year or two than maybe anything prospect-wise, just because it's going to be some time before these guys come up, and then there's an adjustment period.
Yes, and by the time a lot of the guys on this top 10, top 15 are pushing for major league time, yes, the likes of Rosario, Kepler, et cetera, Polanco could already be into the arbitration system, will be into the arbitration system, and who knows if the Twins want to pay them what the system will provide. But, and then, you know, I do think that there's a year-to-year, try-to-stay-relevant-every-year mentality. I don't see this group taking things down to the point of a quote-unquote rebuild. Their term for it is building. They're still building. They don't want to say rebuilding because they're not. They do have pieces. I think you might undersell the positional value a little bit of those guys, even if it has to be move this guy over to this spot, Polanco could move across the bag, whatever. But one of the things, two names we haven't mentioned at all that I don't know how many you would know. I don't get to see your other list until I buy the book, but I wonder how many teams had people like of the ilk of Nick Gordon and Steven Gonsalves fall out of a top 10 after being in the top 5 in the past, if not topping the list like Gordon. So that's and I stand by that. I there was really little reason to protect their top 10 spots, and they're probably in the top 15. But if they were going to be in that top 10, it was going to be toward the back of it. Obviously, they didn't make it. How rare is that these days for guys at that stage of their careers? Gonsalves with just about 5 weeks in the, 6 weeks in the major leagues, and Gordon with none to slide that far.
It does happen, and that is one of the, going with Gonsalves, we saw Steven Gonsalves make his major league debut. Adalberto Mejia did get 4 starts and pitched well in those. Zach Littell came up, made his debut, Aaron Sleager. So there was this young group of pitchers who did at least get their first taste of the major leagues. In regards to Gonsalves, you mentioned he was a top 10 guy for a couple of years in this twin system. Concerns about velocity and command came up this year, 22 walks in 24 innings. Also gave up 28 hits, so he got hit and he walked guys. It wasn't the greatest combination. How much faith or sense was there from anyone you spoke with that Steven Gonsalves can get this turned around and be a serviceable fourth, fifth starter?
Well, that's the thing. I think serviceable and back of a rotation, that doesn't make you think top 10 anymore. I mean, there was a time when there was a, he didn't seem to throw an invisible, and it certainly the changeup was too good for people at the lower to mid levels of the minors. But he has lost a couple miles an hour on the fastball with persistent shoulder problems there for a couple straight years, and all the other things that pushed him so high on that list are still there: the makeup and the competitiveness and the generally smooth delivery. Although he's tinkered with it to try to produce more velocity back to that. So he might just have to trend down into the Tommy Malone range and just be free and easy and pinpoint, but that's pretty hard to do in a velo soaked game. So I think there's still belief in the person, and there's still belief in the overall, but it's not talk about a 2 or a 3 or somebody who has to be in your top 10 anymore. So he got a look. It was smart and wise to. And good for him that he got to the majors, got a chance, had some moments. But, yes, so as you sketched out, walks, walks and hits together, not helpful.
One guy who did come up and was actually okay, given a lot of the rockiness he's been through, was Cole Stewart, obviously a former top 5 pick. His career took a winding path, but came up, not a lot of strikeouts, still a good chunk of walks, but, less than a hit an inning, kept runs off the board, perfectly respectable in his 36 and two-thirds inning debut. Where does he fit in the Twins, plans moving forward?
Well, he'll get a look. I mean, he might end up in middle relief, but he also just might end up forcing his way into the back of the rotation. We'll see. I see if they can get a special waiver where they can only pitch him against the Tigers, because it really seemed to go well for him if you look against the Tigers. But the other thing they liked is, he just reinvented himself in terms of the makeup. He got married, and he let his wife talk some sense into him, and he'll admit that he had taken some things for granted. He was kind of an angry young man, and he changed. He was a different guy in 2018. He was receptive to coaching. They gave him a one-seamer. Blake Treinen one-seamer, and he took to it, and allowed him to even miss a few bats. He's never going to be a strikeout per inning guy, but still heavy ground ball rate, and it was nice to see that happen for Cole Stewart. His debut season in the majors definitely more successful than Gonsalves's, but again, he got to see the Tigers a lot. He did take to the opener, and with Rocco Baldelli as the manager, and his Rays passed. We'll see. I mean, we'll see if the Twins can take the opener throughout the year. I think they're tempted to do so, And if that's the case, there's going to be certain starters that can handle it, certain that can't. Littell took to it, and Cole Stewart took to it with open arms. So that may improve their chances of having a back-end spot as opposed to, say, going out and signing some $8 million starter who's on the downside of his career and has never been asked to be the primary and let somebody else be the opener. So they might go with the kids in that regard.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely interesting. You look at, you know, what's at the major league level. I mentioned, you know, you mentioned Stewart, you mentioned Littell, you mentioned Sleegers. You know, you have a guy like Adalberto Mejia, Steven Gonsalves, a lot of guys who have progressively gotten taste. You know, each made, you know, between 2 and 4 starts last year and got logged some innings. It'll be interesting to see if they can, you know, take on that larger workload moving into next year and how they progress. To wrap up, you had alluded to Nick Gordon earlier as well. Again, another top 10 pick, big pedigree, son of, you know, former All-Star pitcher Tom Gordon. As early as last year, there was some very mixed reviews about him coming out, both from Twins camp and opposing scouts and managers. And then this year, it really kind of came to a head. Did not play well at AAA, and for those of us that watched him at AAA, it was pretty clear he was not at the physicality or skill level of his contemporaries at this exact moment in time at that level. What for you kind of was the overall sense on Nick Gordon and what's next and where he goes from here?
Well, he's still having to try to convince people that he can stay at shortstop, and I don't know that he can anymore. I've heard some dreadful reviews of his shortstop play, even going back to 2017 at Double A. But I mean, he still loves that position, wants to give it a go. But I think at this stage, he's the bat. If everything clicks for him and he can be more consistent with it and hit lefties a little bit, he could be a super utility kind of guy. But for some reason, he is not. Other than a little time at second, decent amount of time at second, he has not been exposed to too much to any other spots, I believe. So, unlike D, so it's probably time to do that if you want to get that former top 5 pick into the major leagues.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. As you said, the Twins are in one of the more interesting spots, I think, just in terms of where they're at the big league level with all the guys they need to get back on the right track. You know, even Max Kepler, who's a fine player, you know, was not great this year. The average really cratered, sub-100 OPS plus, which you don't want to see from a corner outfielder. You know, so seeing if these guys can get back and then these young pitchers, if they can, you know, kind of start to progress and have the farm system follow them, I think that's the recipe, but so much of it is up in the air. Mike, thank you again for all your many, many years of service here with Baseball America. I know the baseball writing world will miss you, but onto a big beat, Notre Dame football, and we look forward to continuing to read your work for the Indianapolis Star.
Yes, and at Mike Berardino on Twitter, we need to replace some of these lost Twitter followers from baseball over the years. So anybody cares at all about college football, or I'm going to do plenty of basketball too, and baseball if Notre Dame can get going in baseball. But you know where to find me. So thanks, Kyle.
No problem. Thanks, Mike. Well, that'll do it for another Baseball America Prospects podcast. For Mike Berardino, I'm Kyle Glazer. Thanks for listening, everybody.